Anjan Sundaram had a lot going for him in the summer of 2005. He'd just completed his master's in mathematics at Yale, was about to begin working towards his PhD, and he'd been offered a high-paying job at Goldman Sachs. But he decided to turn his back on all that and embark on an entirely different career path. In a memoir called Stringer, A Reporter's Journey in the Congo, Mr. Sundaram recounts his decision to leave his comfortable life behind and head to one of the world's most dangerous conflict zones to begin a career in journalism. It's published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that it brings Anjan Sundaram to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
You devoted so many years to mathematics. Why did you decide to switch paths and become a journalist? Was this a sudden decision?
It was. Mathematics is beautiful and interesting and also useful. But the reason you do mathematics is not for its usefulness. You do it for its beauty. And that was wonderful for many, many years. I really enjoyed the worlds I lived in. But at some point, I felt the need to engage in something more immediately in relation to the world.
Yeah. But then you chose to go to one of the most dangerous places in the world, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. You could, of course, have also gone to Chechnya. You could have gone to Peshawar. There are all sorts of other dangerous places. Why Congo?
Oh, there was a cashier at Yale when I was paying my final bill. And I told her that I might go to Congo. It was on my mind, vaguely. And she said, "Oh, you Yale kids, you think you can do anything." And she thought I was completely stupid to think of going to the Congo. But eventually she helped me and I stayed with her in-laws.
Well, did you feel that it was a story that was going underreported?
Absolutely. I'd read that 5 million people had died and that...
More people than died in World War II, if I remember correctly.
Exactly. And it's counting still, 1,000 unnatural deaths every day at this time. And when I showed up in Kinshasa, there were only 3 other journalists there, international journalists.
And why do you think that is? Because we're talking about Africa?
I think the Congolese problem is a hard problem. It's also very far away from us. The way the world engages with Congo so far has been military. The world has sent the largest UN peacekeeping mission to Congo, 17,000 soldiers and 4 journalists. There's a belief that military means will solve Congo's problems, and I think a lack of a realization that information is what we need. We need to hear stories.
How did your family and friends react when you told them that you were going to the Congo to work as a stringer? I mean, beyond the fact that Congo is dangerous, being a stringer isn't exactly the most secure of all jobs.
Not at all. My mother started crying. But to be honest, once I showed up, the family I lived with in Congo, it was middle class, quite poor, in a sort of slum. And on our street were houses in which one person would eat every day. They would choose that person and the others would scavenge. There were houses in which parents would tell their daughters, "Today, you have to fend for yourself," which meant that they had to prostitute themselves. There were houses in which parents could not afford to feed their children. And in order to break their relationship with those children, they would accuse them of being possessed by the devil and have them be exorcised by the church. And I found these children, I described this in the book, in a cemetery, living in the shells of cars. And I think when I narrated these stories to my friends back in the States and my family, I think there began to be an understanding for why I went.
And we're talking about a relatively safe area, Kinshasa. We're not talking about eastern Congo, where most of the killing is taking place.
Absolutely. The interesting thing about Congo, going outside the capital, I went outside once in the middle of the book. I described this journey I undertook on the river, upriver with an Indian businessman to go up to his mine. And what was fascinating about these places outside the capital was that the Congolese government had no authority. It almost did not exist. But this wasn't a story of abandonment. I met a pygmy tribe that had given away their forests, huge swaths of forest, for a few sacks of salt. And these were international logging companies that they'd given their land to, their forest to. I saw mass graves that had been left by foreign armies. I saw I met people asked me for metal detectors. And so their lives were caught up in these global forces that were at play in backcountry Congo.
At Yale, you'd studied under the famous mathematician Serge Lange, who was also known for his political and social activism. Did that relationship influence your decision?
Yes. He spoke to me a great deal about his activism in his youth. And while I was studying mathematics, it was almost entertainment to me. But now looking back, I think there was a profound influence because he was unafraid, even as a mathematician, abstract mathematician, to engage with the world.
Well, how did he react when you told him that you were going to quit math?
He said I was playing the fool. Clearly knew a thing or two about journalism.
And then when you arrived in the DRC, you learned that he'd passed away.
Yes, shortly afterwards.
I'm sure that that made you sad, but you couldn't have done anything anyway.
I couldn't have done anything anyway, and it sort of served to break with America.
And you write that you left for Congo, I'm quoting, in a sort of rage, a searing emotion. Why rage?
I felt I had been shielded from these places. I was 22. I had been shielded from this huge part of the world all my life. And I think something welled up within myself. There was this moment when I went up to the Goldman Sachs offices and I was standing in front of this cubicle. They had offered me a job.
And this is when Goldman Sachs was not under attack.
No, this was in 2007 at the height of the stock market. It was a great time to get a job in finance. And I saw this cubicle and I thought to myself, no, this is not where you want to be for the next few years of your life. You need to go out into the world. That's where you need to be.
Had you done any journalism?
I had done some writing. I had written some short stories, and they had been published in small outlets. But I had very little experience in journalism. I made myself a journalist in a very old school fashion.
What does that mean? You looked at other people's articles and said, how would I have done this?
Initially, when I was in Congo, yes, but maybe 30, 40 years ago, my editor at the AP, who gave me a job, had done exactly what I did. And I think there's a certain purity and naturalness to going out, setting out to find stories rather than being sent.
Well, okay, so you become a stringer, mm-hmm. which means you get paid per word?
Per word, 15 cents. Yes, and no other guarantees.
You have to write long articles.
Oh, they only pay you for words they publish.
And I assume that if you'd said, I want to be a stringer in Paris, you wouldn't have gotten the job.
It's very difficult to find a job as a stringer in the major capitals of the world. It's so competitive. It takes so much time to find even a stable full-time position. My solution was to go out. Journalism nowadays is changing. Media outlets no longer have the resources to put a reporter in every country in the way they used to. And what that has done is open up opportunities for people like me to go to a place like Congo that is uncovered, unreported, and build a career there.
Did you have any preconceived notions of what life and work in the DRC would be like? We're talking about the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. There were two Congos.
Yes, there are two Congos. One was Belgian and one was French. And I was in the Belgian one, the Democratic Republic of Congo. It used to be a Belgian colony.
But is French the second language?
Yes, French is. It was colonized by Francophone Belgium, and I spoke French, which helped me a great deal in my reporting.
What surprised you most when you first arrived?
I think
compared to what you had imagined.
The level of agitation, the heightened states of emotion that I felt upon my arrival was evident, and you could feel it on your skin. In front of my house, I would step out of my house, and there was this gas station where, in this broken country, broken political system, you would find every day 30 men handing out pamphlets with writings against the government, agitating for revolution. There were people on every street corner. I describe one of these characters in my book. His name is Anderson. And he really honestly believes in a brighter future and is agitating for revolution. He wants this to happen. He wants his country to come back to the people, as he called it. And I describe his journey as the elections approach and how he changes.
And I'm assuming that these people were a lot more open with you once they realized that you might write a story about them than if I had just gone there and said, I'm opening up a grocery store.
They're very skeptical of foreign intervention. Foreign intervention in Congo has led to one ill after another, starting from King Leopold, who took Congo as his private property, like his garden, 30 times the size of Belgium, then Belgian colonial rule, and then a series of dictators installed by foreign powers.
Well, when the DRC gained independence from Belgium in 1960, its first prime minister was Patrice Lumumba, and he was, in effect, assassinated at the behest of the Belgian government. Moise Tshombe set up a secessionist province in Katanga, obviously being helped by Belgian business interests. They wanted all the great resources in Katanga. So the Western interference has been a major part of the story. Does it remain a major part of the story?
It does. The story I just told you about going into the Congolese forest and finding these logging companies, where the Congolese government is not present, the world has stepped in, and people's lives are caught up in global forces.
And was Joseph Mobutu the longtime, what word would we use, dictator or
yes.
leader anyway? was he somebody who really was a puppet of the West?
He was. I described this in the book, his relationship with Lumumba. The assassination of Lumumba, which was orchestrated in some way by Mobutu, who was Lumumba's secretary at the time, his personal secretary, was like the loss of a parent for a child. Congo lost its founding father and its vision for future, and from there on they have struggled to find new leaders. Congo's strength is its civil society. You find talented people, intelligent people, good people committed to the development of Congo. But because of this lack of a government, lack of institutions that are able to multiply their force, their actions, their good deeds, and make them greater than the sum of their parts, they find themselves in a void, these good people in Congo.
Are they despairing of the future?
Surprisingly, not. There are people who still work for Congo's future. There's a certain section of society that is broken. You have to, it's evident. People have begun to fear the future because each change has brought only worse. And so they fear the future and not, even reminisce about the past, about dictators who were brutal to them. They are nostalgic and affectionate towards these people.
My guess is Anjan Sundaram, Sundaram. His book, Stringer, A Reporter's Journey in the Congo. How soon did you find yourself being published in the United States?
It took a while. I wrote the book. I began to write the book in 2007, and it took me many, many years to even write the book, because while I was in Congo, I had to build a shell around myself because I was seeing such catastrophic things.
Well, you were sending things to the AP. Did they pick up most of the stories you sent them?
In the beginning, no, but towards the end, almost everything I wrote, it was fabulous.
And the reason they didn't in the beginning is because you didn't write the stories well enough, or they just weren't interested in Congo at first?
I had a very different conception of what the news was. To me, if a group of women were raped on the next street, that was news. But I learned that it doesn't make world news. People have to die in very violent ways, in great numbers. Because 1,000 people die in Congo and so many have died, you need that much, the bar is that much higher for world news.
And if an American tourist is raped on the next block or a European tourist, that's more likely to be a story that will get published.
It's instant news.
You were also robbed a number of times. Did they, because you were a foreigner, do you think?
Yes, I think there was one time I was robbed in a cab by my fellow passengers who put a gun to my head and took everything I had, every last dollar. And it was just after that I got lucky and found the job with the AP. But at home, I realized that the little thefts that I was experiencing at home, my phone, $50, it was part of a deal. I was seen to be wealthier and better off than the people I lived with. And the deal was I needed to let them steal from me to some extent.
What was the political situation when you arrived?
it was a time of great change. People were afraid because the first elections in 40 years were coming up, the first multi-party elections since Lumumba had been elected and assassinated shortly afterwards. That trauma, the trauma of Lumumba's assassination just after elections, was still present in Congo. And I think people were extremely fearful for what this electoral process would bring. There was also there was a sense that power could change hands, and that makes everyone nervous.
Although the present government has not exactly been respected worldwide.
No.
Well, first of all, the current leader is the son of the man who won that election, or is it?
No, it's the same person.
Oh.
Yes, and it's Joseph Kabila, mm-hmm. whose father Laurent Kabila was assassinated in 2001. He had deposed Mobutu in 1997. And Joseph Kabila, his son, is still in power. In 2006, he was seen as a progressive force. He had ended the war, bringing the warring parties together, and somewhat quelled the violence, extreme levels of violence. It's still violent in Congo, but not as violent as it used to be.
Now, as we noted, Congo is extremely rich in natural resources. Why hasn't that trickled down to the populace?
Because government is broken, and the world seems to think it's okay to do business with such a government. So the deals that are struck benefit people in government, benefit the companies, and benefit the foreign countries.
And then it's not just Westerners. It's neighbors. Uganda, Angola, Rwanda are all involved in grabs and in the conflict in eastern Congo. Aren't there Tutus who were involved in the Rwandan genocide now living and fighting in eastern Congo?
There are rebel groups that are supported by Rwanda. Rwanda denies the allegations, but there's evidence, enough evidence to strongly suggest it. And these rebel groups have fought and displaced millions of people in an attempt to grab territory and power and the wealth. Of the mineral wealth that you find in eastern Congo.
Is part of the problem that Congo was so big and there were so many different ethnic and religious groups, many tribes?
That by itself, I don't think, is a huge problem. Lumumba was able to unite Congo. And I think the real problem is a lack of leadership. That is another... the world seems to send outside intervention, foreign intervention, as a means to solve Congo's problems. I think with greater information, if we were to send more journalists there, we would understand that Congo's problems are largely internal, and any solution must have a strong internal component to it.
And large companies, foreign firms like the American mining company Phelps and Dodge, they just stay out of politics?
Absolutely. I tried to visit the premises of Phelps Dodge while I was in Congo. But even through friends at the U.S. Embassy, good friends who knew the work I did and respected it, were unable to get me to those compounds. It was like the sovereign territory of another country.
Foreign companies have been accused of violating or encouraging the violation of laws and human rights.
Yes.
How long did you stay in the DRC?
I stayed for a year and a half.
Why did you leave?
The elections were over, and I felt the story that had come... just after the elections, I was in Kinshasa when the results were announced, and all the foreign journalists had come in to cover the elections. And as soon as the elections were over, the ballots had been cast, they all left. And I was among the few stringers who were committed to Congo and lived there. And as soon as the results were announced, all hell broke loose. And I was among the last journalists who covered that violence.
You didn't come back and pick up on your mathematics career?
No.
You're still in Africa?
Yes. I live in Rwanda. I've been there for the last 5 years.
And you've become an award-winning journalist. Does that mean that you no longer work as a stringer?
I wish. I think I'll always be a stringer at heart. I think that the hustling and the search for stories will always be part of my work and what I do. It's part of who I am.
Anjan Sundaram is an award-winning journalist. He's reported from Africa and the Middle East for the New York Times, the Associated Press, and his writing has appeared in many of the most notable publications. He has written a memoir called Stringer, A Reporter's Journey in the Congo. It is published by Doubleday, and it has been my great pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you.